This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Mr. Speaker, today the House of Commons Standing Committee on Justice and Human Rights, of which I am a member, will begin a very important study into Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. This section prohibits electronic communication that is, quote, likely to expose a person or persons to hatred or contempt by reason of the fact that the person or persons are identifiable on the basis of a prohibited ground of discrimination, unquote. I'm very concerned about this particular section of the Act, Mr. Speaker. Any legislation which limits the ability to speak freely without fear of government reprisal is inappropriate in my view. While it's important to protect Canadians from discrimination, there are already provisions in the Criminal Code to provide recourse in such matters. In my view, this section of the legislation needlessly limits freedom of speech.
That was Conservative MP Brent Rathgaber back in 2010 in the House of Commons, raising concerns about the implications of Section 13 of the Canada Human Rights Act. The provision was later repealed, but it has resurfaced in Bill C-63, better known as the Online Harms Act. My recent podcast with Vivek Krishnamurthy focused primarily on the internet platform regulations that are found in the bill, which have generally been well received. But it's the inclusion of reforms to the Canada Human Rights Act and the Criminal Code that have attracted considerable criticism in the month or so since the bill was first introduced and have sparked calls for, at a minimum, a separation of those provisions from the rest of the bill. Given its importance, the next two episodes will be devoted to conducting deep dives into those specific provisions, starting this week with changes to the Canada Human Rights Act. To help understand the history of Section 13 and its latest iteration, I'm joined by Professor Richard Moon, Distinguished University Professor and Professor of Law at the University of Windsor. The Canadian Human Rights Commission asked Professor Moon to conduct a study on Section 13 in 2008, and his report is the leading source on its history and application. In this episode, we discuss that history and consider the benefits and risks of inserting it into Bill C-63. Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's fantastic for you to come on. There really is no better person in the country, I think, to talk about this particular issue. I've already done one podcast on the Online Harms Act, Bill C-63, but one of the most contentious elements is the Human Rights Act provisions. And there's been a lot of talk about it. I think there are some legitimate concerns. There's also been no shortage of hyperbole. And I thought that you could really help to separate out for us those two issues. You know, where are there legitimate concerns, and where people overstating things? You've been involved in this issue, studied this issue for quite literally decades. So can we start with a bit of the background? You wrote the definitive study for the Human Rights Commission on Section 13 back in 2008. Can you give us a bit of a backgrounder in terms of the provision, its history, and what really prompted the commission to decide that they needed a study on it?
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't know if it was the definitive report or not. It might have been the only report. That makes it therefore definitive, but regardless. So, yeah, so Section 13 was added to the Canada Human Rights Act in, I think it was 1977. And what it provided, because I should add, it was repealed in about 2013, 2014. But what it provided during its life was that speech, and initially it used the language, communication that was telephonic. So telephonic communication that was likely to lead the members of groups defined on grounds that were protected under the code, likely to lead members of group to be exposed to hatred or contempt. So that was what the provision did. Now, it's an interesting story about how it came about or why it came about. So we already had, beginning in 1970, the Criminal Code prohibition on the willful promotion of hatred. And so one might have thought that covered the field in some ways. But a particular issue arose that caused some people to wonder whether or not the Criminal Code provision would be applicable. So the Criminal Code provision prohibits the willful promotion of hatred against, again, members of various groups, other than in public, other than in private conversation. So that's how it was framed. What happened was a racist organization, the Western Guard, had introduced a telephone hate line. You could call up and get your weekly recorded anti-Semitic message, basically. And there was some concern or question about, would the criminal code apply here? Because it applied only to communication with other than in private conversation. And so what about an individual calling up this kind of answering machine, getting this recorded message? Now, you know, there's certainly a very credible argument that that could be viewed as public because it was publicly available. But regardless, that seemed to be one of the concerns. So this provision was enacted. And in fact, the first case that came before the commission, in fact, initiated by the commission, was a case known as Taylor, involving John Ross Taylor, head of the Western Guard. And I'll say no more about that at the moment, but that was the issue. So the provision, of course, applied to telephonic communication. That was ultimately interpreted as including online communication. And in fact, the act was subsequently amended to clarify that online communication would apply. One of the other advantages that was seen in adding this particular provision was that it was understood that it wasn't a punitive process. It would be an easier process to commence rather than the very, you know, cumbersome, process heavy criminal code procedure. And so this was perceived as something that might allow individuals to bring complaints and for hopefully a process that would lead to the takedown of material. So let me just say a little bit about the differences between Section 13 and the human rights process versus the criminal code process. So criminal code, of course, involves a police investigation, a charging of individual with having committed the offense. And in fact, when we're talking about the criminal code provision related to hate speech, the consent of the provincial attorney general is required before a prosecution can proceed. And then, of course, everything else that goes with a criminal prosecution. So the burden of proof, conviction, but then, of course, potentially a more severe penalty at the end of it all. When we're talking about the human rights code process, an individual, a member of the public, can bring a complaint to the commission. The commission would then consider the complaint, and only if the complaint was judged to be trivial, vexatious, made in bad faith, something along those lines, or outside the jurisdiction of the commission, of course, only in those situations would they push it back. Otherwise, they had an obligation to engage in an investigation. And that investigation would ordinarily include speaking to both the parties, the complainant and the individual about whom the complaint was made. The commission would then consider whether or not the complaint had real merit or substance. And if they judged it to have that, they would then refer the complaint to an independent body, the Canada Human Rights Tribunal, which would then adjudicate the complaint and decide whether or not the code provision had been breached. Now, the other part of your question, I guess, was what led to the repeal of this particular provision? What were the concerns or complaints? And I think we come at that in two ways. The reason why I was asked to write the report really was that human rights code prohibitions on hate speech had become the subject of a lot of controversy, and mostly because a couple of complaints that had been made and that were investigated. So one was a complaint about a publication, the Western Standard, that had published the Danish cartoons, the cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad that many people may remember was the subject of lots of controversy long ago. Now, this was a complaint actually brought to the Alberta Human Rights Commission. And I should quickly add, the Section 3 in the Canada Human Rights Act, Section 13 in the Canada Human Rights Act, it applied to telephonic and internet communication, but several other provincial human rights codes included a provision similar to Section 13. So the British Columbia, the Alberta, the Saskatchewan Human Rights Code, as well as the Human Rights Code of the Northwest Territory, included a provision that prohibited communication was likely to lead, likely to expose the members of different groups to hatred or contempt. Now, of course, these codes, the provincial codes, were not applicable to the internet. That's outside of their ordinary jurisdiction, but they would apply to publications, flyers, and things of that character. So a complaint then was made to the Alberta Commission. Now, the commission investigated the complaint, but its investigation process, of course, involved calling in the person against whom the complaint was made and requiring them to explain what they had done, et cetera, et cetera. And this person, which I guess many people may know of, Ezra Levant, is a very good self-promoter. He really made hay with this and, accused the commission of interfering with his free speech and so forth. Now, of course, as I say, in the end, the complaint was dismissed and dismissed in a very early stage in the process. But nevertheless, there was real concern. And the other complaint that arose, which really was what triggered most of the debate and probably was the reason why I was asked to do this report, was a complaint against Maclean's magazine. And Maclean's had published an excerpt from a book by Mark Stein, a book that talked about effectively the Muslim takeover of Europe and had lots of truly odious stuff within it. So the complaint was made to a number of commissions, including the Canadian Human Rights Commission, who decided at a fairly preliminary stage that the complaint didn't have, was unlikely to succeed, and it was not referred to adjudication. However, a complaint was also made to the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal. I should add quickly, in British Columbia at the time, there was no longer a Human Rights Commission. So any complaint automatically went to the tribunal for adjudication. The tribunal could dismiss a complaint in a preliminary way. Interestingly enough, Maclean's didn't actually make application for an early dismissal. I think they really wanted to embrace the process and really get a lot of mileage out of it if they could. In any event, a full hearing was held. And the tribunal dismissed the complaint, decided that Maclean's in publishing this excerpt from Mark Stein had not, in fact, breached the code. But again, that generated huge controversy. A major Canadian publication, is come before a tribunal, and the media really as a whole was beginning to express real concern about these provisions in human rights codes, but Section 13 became the real target, even though there was no complaint pursued ultimately under the Canada Human Rights Act itself. Now, I think, in my report, I try to identify a variety of reasons why I think a human rights code is not the right place to be regulating hate speech. And I made the argument that it is better left to the criminal code. But there were a lot of claims circulating within, the right-wing blogosphere, and even within mainstream media, about the process and about Section 13 in particular, which were just not true. They were just false. There were claims of corrupt behavior that had absolutely no merit, no substance whatsoever. They were founded on nothing. And certain things were claimed, like the Canada Human Rights Commission has 100% conviction rate. That got said over and over again. And it made no sense. It made no sense because, of course, during the period I looked at, the commission had, I think, about 75 complaints brought to it, not a large number, brought to it under Section 13. They dismissed half of them as not really having merit, either in a preliminary way or later on in the process, and ultimately referred a number to the tribunal for adjudication, but most of those got sorted before a hearing was actually held by the tribunal. So there are really only about 15, 16 cases and that the tribunal adjudicated. And it's true that in each one of them, they decided that the code had in fact been breached. Now, I forgot to mention earlier, it's important to recognize that when we're talking about the Human Rights Code, the principal remedy when a tribunal finds that there's a breach is an order to cease and desist a particular behavior, the communication of hateful views. There was some discretion to give a compensatory order and so forth. But that was the principal order. So it was perceived as not being punitive in character.
So you weren't convinced by many of the criticisms of the law and the associated system, but I know that you did have some concerns. What were they?
The concerns I had really with the process were not the things that were circulating online, which, as I say, were really quite groundless. They were, first of all, the process put a huge burden on a complainant, an extraordinary burden. The complainant would not only bring the complaint, but they were responsible for making the case before the tribunal, which is an awful lot to ask of a private citizen in that circumstance. And in fact, as you may know, there really was one complainant behind almost all of the complaints that were adjudicated and went to tribunal. And it was a huge burden on him. I mean, he decided this was something he was going to do, and he was subject to death threats and all kinds of things. So that was one concern I had. I mean, another was when a complaint is brought to the tribunal, it is required to investigate that complaint unless it judges it to be trivial in character or made in bad faith. And of course, that meant that even complaints that were very unlikely to succeed were going to be investigated. And as soon as you start an investigation process that pulls the parties and pulls in particular the person against whom the complaint has been made into a process, then one can legitimately say that raises concerns about free speech and chilling speech and so forth. So individuals could be brought into the process even though there was very, very little likelihood that their speech, in fact, amounted to hate speech. So I think that was another concern. And I would tie that into a larger concern is that human rights codes are about discrimination broadly understood. They prohibit discrimination, not just discrimination as intentional in character, malicious in character, but what we refer to as effects discrimination or constructive discrimination. When a business might put in place a particular policy or rule that on the face of it would not appear to be discriminatory or exclusionary, but nevertheless, in its operation, it has that effect. And so you can have many, many situations where you have an individual who is not badly motivated. They just either didn't realize, even though perhaps they should have, that their rule or their action might have this disadvantaging effect on the members of particular groups. And so it's for that reason that human rights codes are generally said to be about conciliation, education, and at most remedying a situation. Sometimes even compensating an individual, but they're not meant to be punitive, we're told. Now, the problem is when we're talking about hate speech, we're talking about really extreme speech. There's good reason why we restrict, why we limit the prohibition on hate speech to very, very extreme speech. And that kind of prohibition does not fit well into this kind of conciliatory process and the broad understanding we have of what human rights codes are meant to do. So there's a real tension, I think, between the process and the general ethos of a human rights code and what we're trying to get at when we're talking about a prohibition on hate speech.
Okay. That's a tremendous backgrounder, both in terms of the law and as well as how it played out with particular cases and some of the concerns that you identified. So you've identified, in some ways, almost the ill fit that may exist or some of the challenges that exist by trying to bring in this particular kind of harm into the Human Rights Act frame. And clearly, those were the concerns you identified in the study. What kind of recommendations did you make? And then you hinted or you noted that ultimately the Harper government repealed that provision. Can you talk a bit about the recommendations and then what takes us to this moment now is to sort of bring the history up to Bill C-63?
Yeah. Okay. So I guess my principal recommendations were first, a very simple one, and that was to repeal Section 13. that I just didn't think the regulation of hate speech belonged in the Human Rights Code frame, and the process was just not the appropriate process to deal with something as extreme as hate speech. And therefore emphasized that it would be better to employ the criminal code when dealing with it. And the criminal code meant that a complainant or the victim of hate speech was not responsible for having to take the case through and all of that. You know, there are concerns, obviously, back then. I want to say they're all different now, but in this new communication landscape. But there were concerns then about how well-equipped the police were to investigate hate crimes. And there was a movement in different provinces, different police forces to develop some expertise around that. And I recommended and emphasized that. But with regard to Section 13, then it was primarily recommending the repeal of Section 13, or in the alternative, to make some changes. First, for example, allowing the commission, giving the commission greater discretion to dismiss a complaint in a preliminary fashion. In the alternative, if the government doesn't want to repeal Section 13, one thing they could do first was to give the commission greater discretion to dismiss a complaint in a preliminary way if it thought the complaint was unlikely to succeed. But if I also suggested that they should clarify the definition of hate speech, it was true that the courts, when there was a challenge to this particular provision brought before the courts, and the Supreme Court of Canada ultimately determined that the section was constitutional, that while it breached the freedom of expression right, it was nevertheless a justified restriction under Section 1 of our Charter. In the course of making that decision, the court had made pretty clear that the speech that was caught by this provision, just like under the criminal code, was only extreme speech, speech that expressed the vilification or detestation of the members of a particular group. It's also true that the tribunal itself had defined hate speech in very narrowly as very extreme speech, and they in fact had ultimately developed what they described the hallmarks of hatred, which were examples of what might count as hate speech. And this was really extreme stuff. We're talking about speech that describes the members of a group as subhuman, animalistic, or inherently violent in character. So it was true that the tribunal and the courts had interpreted this provision, its scope, very, very narrowly. At the same time, the language of the code was very open, very broad, and easily misconstrued, at least by the general public. And so I suggested that they should probably make clear that we're only talking about very extreme speech. There were a number of other very minor things. But, you know, as I indicated earlier, I don't think any of these were the reasons why Section 13 was repealed. I think it was really repealed because there was a kind of especially among conservative voters, a real concern about the provision that was grounded, unfortunately, on misinformation.
The section, as you say, does get repealed for the reasons you've just articulated, but it's back in Bill C-63, right. And as mentioned off the top, has really become one of the lightning rods of this legislation. Can you describe a bit what the bill now says? It's not an identical Section 13. What does the bill say? And, you know, why don't we start there?
I think the first thing to say is that this is happening in an entirely different landscape than when I was looking at Section 13, you know, a number of years ago. I mean, when I was looking at Section 13 and thinking about online hate was happening in on these websites at the margins of the internet that you wouldn't even know about unless you looked for them. I was completely unaware of their existence until I undertook this particular task. And so on these websites, you had individuals who were already sympathetic to very bigoted racist views who are really feeding off each other. And a legitimate concern might be when these individuals get together, you know, they can embolden each other in different ways, and you don't know what the consequences of that might be. But now, of course, the landscape is so different, and most hate speech is happening, you know, on social media platforms of different kinds in ever larger, I suppose, networks or friendship networks and so forth. It spreads so much more rapidly and so much more widely than it did at this earlier stage. So everything I had to say at that earlier stage was tied to that particular environment or landscape, and things have changed. And so we have to think about what Section 13 means in this new landscape. So the provision is significantly the same as the earlier provision, but there are some significant changes that are probably, you know, reflect some of the concerns I had at this earlier time, but you know, maybe don't make a lot of sense at this point. So one of them is they have sought to clarify or strengthen the definition of what counts as hate speech. And when they talk about hate speech now in this code, in the new version of Section 13, it refers specifically to speech that is expresses detestation, vilification against the members of a group. And the code provision specifically talks about hate speech that occurs in a context that is likely to foment detestation and vilification. So, I mean, I think that's a positive thing to have sought to clarify the definition and really emphasize we're talking about extreme speech. And they've also sought to make clear that this does not extend to speech that is simply offensive or hurtful or that may ridicule or whatever. So they've also sought to exclude certain things that individuals might imagine would count as hate speech. So that's one change. I mean, another change is they have given the commission more discretion to dismiss a complaint if it thinks the complaint is like unlikely to succeed. So that, I guess, could, at least at the earlier stage, might have enabled the commission to reduce its workload and might have led to fewer investigations, even investigations that obviously did not ultimately lead to tribunal adjudication. So those are important changes. At the same time, they've increased some of the monetary penalties that are available. The original version of Section 13 didn't actually include, if I'm remembering correctly, any kind of monetary penalty. It included amount which an individual up to a certain amount could be compensated for harm or injury they experienced, but did not include a kind of monetary penalty per se. Ultimately, before its repeal, a number of years before, such a penalty was in fact introduced, but a lower level than what I think is being talked about here. And one of the issues about human rights codes was they're not meant to be punitive in character. And that has always been the way in which it's been explained why it's not so troubling that there's no intention requirement in the human rights code. You don't have to prove that the individual against whom the complaint is made intended to spread hatred or intended to expose individuals to hatred or contempt. Intention, of course, is significant and vital in the criminal code provision. You have to show the individual willfully spread, promoted hatred. So the absence of an intention requirement at the same time as having a penalty might be seen as problematic, although the penalty provision specifically talks about it. I'm trying to think the language, talks about willfulness or intent as a factor in determining whether or not a monetary penalty should be imposed. So those are the changes. Now, the larger problem, of course, is this. We've come to recognize that the traditional legal responses, even with these modifications, simply aren't up to the task of addressing online hatred. They're too slow, they're too cumbersome. The stuff spreads so fast, so widely, it's difficult to imagine how they can work. And the irony of this bill, I guess, overall is the establishment of a duty to act responsibly with oversight by this particular agency that will be established, assuming the bill goes ahead. It rests upon a recognition that traditional legal responses can't do it. And so that's the kind of irony of all this, that we've got that at the core, and that seems to be the vital part of this bill. And then we have these peripheral elements like Section 13, which in many respects are just distracting public conversation from what is the core. So my main concern about reintroducing Section 13 is, first, well, is it going to be effective at all? It just really isn't up to the task of dealing with hate speech online. Will the commission, even with this greater ability to dismiss a complaint in a preliminary fashion, will it just be overwhelmed with complaints by individuals, and so the whole system just breaks down? Or if they're not overwhelmed with a whole lot of complaints, will there just be a select number, which just seems distorting, unfair? I mean, under the old version of Section 13, one of the complaints, which was an unfair complaint, was that the commission was targeting different communities. That was an unfair complaint because the commission wasn't initiating the complaints themselves. The commission was simply receiving complaints and then investigating them. But nevertheless, that was one of the sort of misleading claims that was made. And I worry that if there aren't a lot of complaints, then that concern will arise again, complaints that are brought to the commission. That concern will arise again, in which people say, oh, you know, the commission is just targeting certain groups in some way. Now, I guess with all that said, if the duty to act responsibly works and does manage to catch a lot of this material and not in an overly broad fashion, we know it's going to be imperfect, whatever it is. But nevertheless, if it does, then maybe there will be a residual number of cases or recalcitrant hate promoters online, and maybe there will be room still for the criminal code and Section 13. I don't know. I'm skeptical about that, but nevertheless, maybe that's a possibility. I do think, I guess, ultimately, the real risk is they'll just be overrun with complaints and the whole thing will just break down.
It's a really valuable observation that not only are the criminal code, and in particular, in this case, the Human Rights Act provisions, you know, sort of an ill fit from the perspective of trying to deal with platforms as in much of the rest of the bill, but in many respects are actually take opposite type approaches and are just inconsistent with one another in approaches. I haven't heard someone articulate that, but I think it's absolutely right, which is it's a really important observation. You've hinted at some of these answers, but I guess I want to ask them anyway, because in the public sphere, we are seeing a number of criticisms, and I sort of wanted to get your take specifically on them. We've had, for example, the former chair of the tribunal has been pretty vocal speaking out against this provision. What are your thoughts, or how do you respond to concerns about the prospect that this will have a chilling effect on speech, that even with some of these definitions, that the reality is, to the extent people think about this stuff, this will have the effect of chilling the speech? You've already talked about the weaponization of complaints and the both the prospect that there's a lot or too little, but all of that around, what are the implications of all of this, do you think, from a speech perspective?
Yeah, I'm not so sure I'm concerned about, you know, its weaponization. Of course, there will be individuals who bring complaints, or it's likely there will be individuals who bring complaints that really don't have much merit. And of course, anytime a complaint is made against somebody, that feels chilling in some ways. That feels troubling and disturbing. I think that if the commission is in a position to dismiss these complaints, and it appears that it is in this very quick, rapid fashion, I don't think ultimately that will be a great problem or concern. Not like it was before, where the commission felt some kind of obligation to go through a full inquiry, even though the complaint was very unlikely to succeed. So I don't know if I'm so concerned about that, but it's hard to know. It's unpredictable how it will play out and how the commission decides to deal with complaints.
I do want to ask you about the tribunal powers. So you've identified the fact that at a minimum, the commission has the ability to dismiss complaints early on, but where there are complaints that do make their way to the tribunal, we've seen criticisms that have focused on the legal cost award elements here, about the prospect of anonymous complainants. What are your thoughts as to whether about the tribunal process itself? Are there or should there be concerns about that?
Yeah, I mean, I should say that under the old version, when I looked at it, the cases that went to the tribunal for adjudication and in which the tribunal decided that, in fact, the code provision had been breached, they were all really extreme speech. They were almost all anti-Semitic speech, and in many cases, calling for the death of Jews. It was really extreme stuff. So in terms of the outcome of those cases, I don't think it was troubling at all. The process, again, was my principal concern, how we got there and how cases that were unlikely to succeed were dealt with and so forth. But its history suggests the adjudication only of very extreme claims. I'm not so troubled in and of itself by the tribunal adjudication process. One of the problems, again, historically under the old version, was that the complainant had carriage. The complainant had responsibility for making the case, and that was a real burden. I mean, often they could employ counsel, although the principal complainant in most of these cases was himself a lawyer. In terms of the powers that the tribunal has, well, as I say, in almost all cases, the principal or certainly even the exclusive remedy was an injunction. So an order to cease and desist this particular behavior. And again, I don't think that's particularly troubling as an order. So really the question is the punitive character. And it's hard to know when that would be utilized. There was not a lot of experience with it under the old provision because it was introduced fairly late into the life of Section 13. But it seemed pretty clear, or at least seemed to be understood, that monetary penalty would only be imposed if it was determined that the individual had intended. There was some malice operating here. And as I say, all the cases I saw that were adjudicated by the tribunal were really, really extreme speech. So, you know, it's anybody's guess as to how this will unfold. I actually, as I've said, I think it's more likely that the process will just not be able to function very effectively. There'll be a gigantic backlog because there's likely to be so many complaints. Human rights commissions and tribunals across the country already struggle to keep reasonable timelines in considering hearing and adjudicating cases because they just are under-resourced and they are often overwhelmed. This will only add, I think, to the challenges.
Okay, why don't we conclude with this? You've already hinted at the question of effectiveness of this provision in Bill C-63, but I think it bears repeating. You know, alongside the criminal code provisions, this is where much of the debate and the criticism has landed. So I guess it begs the question, is it worth it? Is this provision likely to have a significant effect in countering hate online?
I think the unfortunate thing about the inclusion of Section 13, not unlike the addition of certain far more severe penalties like life imprisonment attached to other criminal code sections, is really that it's about optics. And I think that's really unfortunate because I do think it really detracts from the important core of this bill, which needs to have a serious conversation and really work it out as best we can, because it really is the only way for us to try and address online hate or other forms of harmful speech, unlawful speech. And I know that there were many, many groups who were very disappointed with the repeal of Section 13 and really did not stop pressing for its reintroduction. And the Liberal government early on signaled its intention to reintroduce some version of Section 13. But as I say, it feels to me like it's mostly optics, mostly appearance, why they've done it. And of course, again, the problem is, and the optics might be bad too. For many people, they were seen as important to include this. The government wants to signal that it takes hate speech and other forms of unlawful speech very seriously. And they seek to indicate that by saying life imprisonment when we're talking about a potential sentence, at least when we're talking about a hate crime of some kind, or life imprisonment when we're talking about the promotion of genocide. It signals they take it very seriously to these different groups. At the same time, the optics to many people are not good. They really look like, well, we're introducing Section 13 despite all the issues or problems with it, or despite it's almost certainly going to be ineffective in addressing the problem, or life imprisonment attached in theory to, I don't know, a, a racist act of vandalism. I mean, nobody imagines that a judge will impose that, but it's there on the books, and that's just, the optics are terrible. So I think that's also another irony in all this, is they're trying to appeal with pretty much empty stuff to a particular community and are going to alienate and raise concerns among others at the same time with these fairly empty provisions.
It has been a real masterclass in identifying sort of the history behind this. It's been great. And then also what the existing limitations and sort of some of the real questions as to why the government has chosen to include this in what almost feels like an omnibus style bill when it comes to online hate. So thank you for taking the time to unpack the history and to give a sense of where I think people should be paying some attention when they start talking specifically around these kinds of provisions.
Well, thanks so much, Michael, for having me.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.